You can't replace part of the brain. Like, you
treat them the same.
The source of truth for the medtech industry.
Coexists with the
robot. Robot understands things automatically.
Number one show in the medtech industry.
So Stryker got ahead of that and changed it. In the 90s, built a $1 billion company. It helped up high. A lot of things.
State of medtech.
With your host, Omar M. Khatib.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Another exciting episode as part of our exit series. Now, whenever a medtech company gets acquired, it's an exciting event. It's great. It's a huge payoff for the investors, the founders. The problem though is that I've noticed historically, these events are never documented in terms of what was done, what levers were pulled in back rooms when it comes to the negotiation, what clinical studies were done, what was important, what was not important, what are the painful lessons learned. Usually those are limited to, you know, private conversations between founders over dinner, if you're lucky to have them. So I decided to do this, these episodes and this series called Exits to bring them into light. And we keep getting bigger, more exciting exits onto the show. So this one's a very exciting one, mainly because of the dynamic of the guests who come on. So let me tell you a little bit about the companies and what happened. So in a quick snippet, essentially, Inari Medical announced a definitive agreement to acquire LimFlow SA for a total upfront cost about $250 million paid in cash upon closing, contingent consideration of up to $165 million in additional cash payments are subject to this achievement of certain commercial and reimbursement milestones, and it will be paid out between 2025 and 2027. Now, who is Inari and who is LimFlow? Let me tell you a little bit about both, okay? So let's start with Inari. So Inari is a publicly traded company, okay, based out of Irvine, California. And their whole mission is that instead of repurposing arterial devices, Inari is pioneering venous-specific devices with venous anatomy and clot morphology in mind. They focus on critical vessels of venous disease, and they design tools to treat both pulmonary embolism and deep vein thrombosis. I visited their booth last year at TCT. Really cool technology. I mean, they've been around for a while, but you know, seeing their technology in person, their suite of products is really exciting. It's one of the reasons why I love being in this industry. Now, who is LimFlow? Okay, LimFlow, Lim spelled L-I-M. Okay, LimFlow is a minimally invasive fashion approach where essentially they designed a system to bypass blocked arteries in the leg, okay, which causes ischemia. By doing this, they rush blood back into the foot, potentially avoiding major amputation and resolving pain and promoting wound healing. The really cool thing about LimFlow is that it's, in my opinion, like when I see this procedure, which you'll, if you're watching on Spotify or YouTube, we bring it up and you'll see the video. What I love is that it's such a cool example of great medtech, where essentially they take a approach, they bypass a problem, they revascularize a limb, but also in the process create an artery, right? And with their technology. So it's a really, really cool tech and very exciting. Now, who do we have on the show? So the first person that we have is Daniel Rose, who essentially was the chief executive officer, CEO of LimFlow. But at the same time, we have Kinam Hong, Dr. Kinam Hong, who is a physician by training, but is also a partner over at Sophie Nova Partners, is one of the investors and advisors involved with LimFlow. So this is a great dynamic to hear both from the CEO of the company, but also one of the people who are heavily involved on the investment side and the board. So it's a great dynamic. You learn quite a lot. So before we get into the episode, just couple quick shout outs. Number one, which is finding early adopters is really difficult. When it comes to finding physicians who are going to adopt your technology, it's not enough to just look at who published the most, et cetera. You want to look at procedure volume. You want to see who has certain financial relationships within the industry and with what companies. And that's why I use Alpha Sophia. There's a lot of great platforms out there. Two problems. Number one, they're usually clunky databases. They're kind of difficult to use. The second thing is they're really expensive. So for startups, I love Alpha Sophia. I use them with all of my clients, okay? And Alpha Sophia essentially helps you look through both commercial data and Medicare, Medicaid data to identify who are the best physicians based on their procedure volume, their prescriptions. They also include things such as social media handles and contact information, which is very valuable. I love their platform. I constantly use it for my clients. The best part is that it's affordable for every startup. Their base package starts at $300 a month. It's like really affordable. And even their most premium tier package is still a lot more affordable than anybody else in the market. So to get a little taste of what they do. You can get three free reports by going to alphasophia.com/Omar. That's alphasophia.com/Omar. And finally, for those of you who are wanting to get on the show, many people have this misconception that you have to have, I don't know, like some big exit or you have to have raised a lot of money. I'm looking for people who are early stage founders because this show serves as a place to give back to the ecosystem and help you get more awareness in front of investors and in front of strategic. And this is not a pay to play thing. We're looking to have people on so that way we can spend our own money here on the State of MedTech to promote you. So if you're interested in that, submit your form below in the show notes. There's a little form where you can click submit, or you can go to even our LinkedIn page and find the form there and submit to be on the show. And lastly, if you're a founder and you're struggling with commercial traction, you know, the moment you get money, it's really hard to figure out like, who do we hire as a VP of sales? Do we hire a sales team, et cetera, because we need to get early adopters? Well, this is where Kateeb & Co. come into play. We use digital sales strategies and processes along with growth marketing to attract those early adopters. We develop a pipeline for you. We have our own database where we find early adopters and we develop those lead lists for you. And this is a great way to, for us to collaborate, whether you have a sales leader that we can help out, or perhaps you don't even have a sales leader, in which case we can do this for you. So if you want to learn more about how we can help you sell and find early adopters, go to kateebandco.com. That's K-H-A-T-E-E-B as in boy, A-N-D-C-O.com to learn more, or just hit me up on LinkedIn. And now let's get into our episode on the exit of Lymph Flow to Inari Medical with Dan Rose and Kinam Hong. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. And again, we have a wonderful episode with a great company. You know, these exit series are always the best because it's a great example of fantastic companies that have done a great job delivering a very valuable technology that's going to save patient lives. And that they had, of course, the great exit that all startup founders want to have. And so today we are joined by Dr. Kinam Hong and Dan Rose of Lymph Flow. Let me give you a little bit of background on Lymph Flow. Lymph Flow is a medical device company who is essentially treating chronic limb threatening ischemia, which of course, which is part of the reason why they have this amazing name, Lymph Flow, L-I-M-F-L-O-W. Okay. And they were recently, not so recent, but acquired by Inari Medical. Okay. Inari acquired them for a total of $415 million. And that was $250 million in cash at closing and eligible to receive $165 million in additional payments. And so we're going to talk about the science behind the technology, the rough times, you know, the lessons learned. And of course, what did they do to architect this deal? Because what's really exciting, and we don't see this so often in med device. First of all, they were the only med device exit last year, to my knowledge. And the other thing that's interesting is that they architected this exit right after they cleared FDA, right? So it was super exciting. So gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the show. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having us. It's exciting. Yeah,
thanks for having us, Omar.
Absolutely. So look, we jumped to kind of the end of the story, which is like, hey, we got a big exit and everything. Let's go back to the very beginning. First of all, how do you guys know each other and how is Lymph Flow conceived?
That's a great question. It's been a long incubation of the company. The idea behind Lymph Flow, at least the surgical predicate, is actually about 110 years old. So that was the first, in the literature attempt to essentially use a vein to deliver arterialized blood. The idea, which, you know, people had tried over the years, small surgical series, some encouraging results, some not. But ultimately, in 2012, Dr. Martin Rothman, very well-known British interventional cardiologist, also was chief medical officer for Medtronic Vascular, had the idea to essentially apply this concept in the lower limb, right, where we know there's a huge need because we have so many people with atherosclerosis, right, building up of plaque and calcium in the arteries. And, you know, again, I think MedTech originally focused on the heart, right? But ultimately, you know, if you're accumulating in the heart, you're accumulating it everywhere, right? So you're going to have ultimately ischemia related to the arteries being blocked. So he thought, well, this is an idea, a surgical predicate that with modern endovascular tools, maybe we can make it, finally a therapy that can have the benefit of the restoring of oxygenated blood to the foot outweigh the surgical insult. And this is the story of so many devices, right? If you think about what coronary stenting is, it's replacing CABG, right? If you think about what TAVR is, it's replacing open heart surgery. There was an old surgical predicate here. And so the idea was, hey, this seems like it should work. Let's try and build a suite of endovascular tools, make it simple, fast, or at least reasonably fast, easy, trainable, adoptable, and see if we can prove that it can restore blood flow, heal wounds, and ultimately keep people from losing their limb. So there was this kind of 100-year period of not much progress. And then again, a brilliant interventional cardiologist looking around and saying, hey, maybe we can do something here. Of course, hard to do as an independent physician building a company. Martin had done it a couple times before, but ultimately he brought the idea to MD Start, which is an incubation fund that was originally set up by Medtronic, Sorin, Sofinnova, Versant Ventures, and Covidien. So that tells you how long ago it was, right? It was before Covidien was acquired and before Sorin was acquired. And their job was to basically take ideas that physicians have and bring to Medtronic or bring to Covidien and say, can you make a company out of this? And put them in the hands of some early stage entrepreneurs who can try and incubate it until you can tell whether it's going to be a real thing. So our link to Sofinnova goes back to 2012. That's when Sofinnova was sitting on the board of MD Start, investing in MD Start. So ultimately, it was some Sofinnova money that came into the company to incubate it. And then, I joined in 2016 when the company was just coming out of incubation and there were no employees. I was the first employee. So it was just kind of a virtual company at that point. And then so my role has been for the past 7 years taking it from this kind of first suite of tools and first set of data to ultimately, New England Journal of Medicine publication, FDA approval, U.S. commercialization, and acquisition.
Fantastic. And, in a moment, I do want to bring up, the new lymph flow procedure animation, because, again, for me, having a medical background, everything, I was so impressed with this because I'll kind of fanboy it in a second as to why I love devices like this. But Kinam, you're a physician. I saw, you were at University of Florida, but very much like me, after you kind of saw the writing on the wall, you probably decided, hey, I probably have a better career in the startup world and everything. How did you get introduced to LymphFlow and what was your involvement with them?
Yeah, sure. So I remember meeting Dan in the, I guess, fall, September of 2017. So it's been about 6 years or so. And I was approached by one of the partners of MD Star, which is an incubator fund, a few months before and said, you should meet one of our companies that are maturing to a late stage company. And that's when we met a few months later. And to maybe tell you as a physician what that meant, the way I got into the business, by the way, I wasn't always a scientist or a physician or wanting to be in the field. But when I was a freshman in college, I remember Magic Johnson on November 7th, 1991, who was one of my biggest idols. I'm a big NBA fan and the Lakers fan with Kareem and really all the championships that won. And he announced that he had HIV. And I was really, really curious about what HIV was. And I remember him talking about not only that he had HIV, but something that stuck with me is he said, it's like your back is against the wall. And I think that you just have to come out and swinging. And I'm swinging. And that has to do with the sort of the stigma of HIV at the time, 30 years ago, right? And so that really had a profound effect on me as a college student. And that's one of the reasons why I sort of seeked out one of the HIV labs. I found out there was a lab at University of Florida that was doing HIV research. Of course, that led to many things, including my career in medicine and currently what I'm doing now. So as a physician, we really look for companies that can have an impact on patient lives and really profoundly. And when I spoke with Dan in September of 2017, everything just sort of made sense. And I remember one of the things really hit me, and he said, What we're trying to do is save the leg. When you save the leg, you save the lives. Because patients with amputation who get amputated, their five-year survival is less than 30%. It's like cancer or worse than many of the cancers. So really the story and Dan's statement resonated with me then. When you actually go through the technology and the data, everything really makes sense. Of course, in the beginning, that's the intuition. I remember leaving that first meeting really excited about the company. And then at the same time, as an investor, of course, we have to do the work, due diligence. We have to look at the data and everything else. And it took us about 8 months to get that done. It was a long process, but we were able to actually get the deal done. And certainly 5 years later, it was our first investment as well as our first exit.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Now, if you guys don't mind, before we get into more details about the story and everything, I kind of want to bring up your video and either one of you feel free to sort of give us a play-by-play. But I also, when we finish the video, I want to share why I really love the technology, got quite excited about it. So for the viewers who are watching on Spotify and YouTube, again, I want to just point this out, which is this is one of those areas where it's very clear that patients need innovation because you get CLTI, 25% of them either end up dying or 30% end up getting amputated, right? That's terrible, right? And so I wanted to kind of just point that out so people realize like how big of an issue this was. And now I want to show the video here.
Yeah, I mean, so the patients we're treating typically have complete lack of blood flow or almost complete lack of blood flow to their lower limbs. So we call it desert foot. Their feet are cold and dry. And so the idea is to connect the artery and vein. We do that by passing a catheter up from a vein in the foot and also passing a catheter from really the farthest down you can go to cross over, right? Because if you have a CTO that runs, you know, 200, 300 centimeters, you're not going to be able to go from one side to the other. So what we then use is a pair of catheters that allow us to target the venous catheter from the arterial side. Then with the needle that crosses from artery to vein, we pass a wire down the hollow point of that needle. And we're then able to capture the wire on the other side and pull it out from the foot. And at that point, you really have access to both the arterial and venous side. We dilate that anastomosis so we can pass catheters down. And then the idea is, well, veins are different than arteries, right? They're a completely different structure anatomically. So, and veins have valves in them, and valves keep blood from flowing in the wrong direction. And we want arterial blood, red blood, to flow in the wrong direction. So we use a tool and call it a valvulotome. It's unique to LimFlow, which allows us to essentially nick and make incompetent those valves atraumatically. And so then we see blood flowing down into the foot and especially into the forefoot where most of the wounds are. And then we place covered stents, which channel the blood from the crossing point on the arterial side across into the vein and down to the ankle. So when we really have a lot of pressurized arterial oxygenated blood, you know, really getting down to where it needs to go, which is the deep tissue of the foot. So we have three catheters in essence, an arterial catheter, a venous catheter, a valvulotome, and then essentially four different stents. Well, it depends on the length of the patient, but we have a crossing stent, which is has a smaller diameter on the arterial side and a bigger diameter on the venous side. And then straight stents that just take the blood down past the ankle.
The viewers, I just want to point out when I learned about LimFlow and I saw it, what got me excited is that, you know, for me in medical devices, seeing a company that does not just anatomical engineering. So a lot of times like stents and everything, that's, you know, introducing some, you know, changing the anatomy. But this is physiological engineering because essentially you're taking a vein, right, which again, vein does not have any kind of muscles in it, right? And converting it into an artery, redirecting the blood flow through that anastomosis, and then revascularizing a limb is just such a great example as to why I love this industry. People ask me, "Hey, Omar, you left tech and SaaS. Why did you come back to med device?" Your company is a great example of that. And I just had to show that visual. You know, usually I don't show the videos too often on show, but I had to show that. So it was just super exciting. Kinyam, when you saw this, you know, what was the sort of aha moment where you're like, wow, we got something here?
Yeah, sure. So when I said earlier, talking to Dan, seeing the presentation and hearing what Dan had to say, it made sense, right? Anatomically, perfusing the blood by using another conduit or the vein, even though maybe not as sort of intuitive as a thing, it makes sense, right? Now, can the vein handle the pressure? Can it act like an artery? And when you do perfuse the leg and the foot, how does the blood come back? Of course, we had many questions, but once again, looking at the technology, it seemed very innovative, and the way it looked, it seemed just makes sense to me as an investor, right? And then I think what got me convinced is, of course, when we invested, was just more than the illustration or the video that you see. The company had data in about 60 patients or so, and the data was fantastic. You had data at that time, I believe, Dan, correct me, but going out to maybe several years or so. So these patients were being saved from being amputated, but also these patients were living longer beyond several years or 6 months, which the clinical endpoint being in phase three. So the technology, I would say, and the clinical data, it both validated for me that this could really work.
I would just say that I think the thing that often excited people is that we, you know, there are lots of similarities across disciplines in med tech, right? Lots of stories that look the same. And we were starting by treating, and that is still is our indication, of course, treating what's called no-option patients. So patients who could not get any further endovascular surgical treatment. So essentially consigned to amputation. So these are the sickest, hardest, most fragile, you know, CLTI patients that exist. But the concept was, if we can help those patients, the worst of the worst, the sickest of the sick, you know, we're going to be able to show real impact. Paired with that, LimFlow always used hard endpoints, not surrogate endpoints, hard endpoints. So I tell people, we don't do patency studies. That's not what we're doing. We're doing amputation and death studies, right? Because that's what the patient cares about, pain, amputation, and not losing their life. And these hard endpoints, when you start to generate great data, seeing 75% limb salvage at 6 months in patients who are going to get amputated, and you see these wounds healing, right? And you see the feet staying warm and the patient's getting active again. It's obvious to everybody that there's something there. And that, I think, is how we attracted the first investors. And Sophie Nova continued to see that confirmed as we gathered more and more data.
Fantastic. And I think this is the part that's very important for people to understand, is that when you have very good science backed by very robust R&D, you know, you put yourself in the best position to win. One of the things I want to bring up is I think finding early adopters and architecting the right clinical studies is so important, because you essentially have to, you know, let's face it, and Kinam, correct me if I'm wrong, with physicians, you're not trained to take risks and do things differently. You're trained to follow things by standard. And so to convince a physician to change their behavior and adopt something new is a really big deal. One of the things that stood out to me was the PROMISE 2 study that you guys had that went in the New England Journal of Medicine. Fantastic results. And essentially, you know, you guys, I'm just going to, you know, summarize it here, that you guys had 105 patients who were enrolled. And the conclusion of the study was that transcatheter arterialization of deep veins was safe and could be performed successfully in patients with chronic limb-threatening ischemia and no conventional surgical or endovascular revascularization treatment options. Which, you know, for this audience listening, aka that means that we have a new standard here. Can you guys talk about what were the steps leading up to doing this study and publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine? How did you decide to pick the right researchers, the right study? If you can talk about the engineering of that.
Yeah, I mean, designing and running clinical trials in a new space is exciting, aka terrifying, right? And really an art. And thankfully, one of my first hires was gentleman by the name of Thomas Engels, who is a brilliant clinical trials leader and really partnered with me along with Zachary Woodson, who was our head of regulatory. Because remember, you can design whatever trial you want, but you really are focused on what the FDA will accept for you to do, right? And so, you know, essentially the core focus from when I joined was to start our early feasibility study, which was originally supposed to be only 10 patients, and understand essentially, because we didn't know very much. We had, you know, like Keenum said, I think, well, when we started EFS, you know, like 40 or 50 patients done. And so we hadn't worked out all the kinks, right? But that's why it's called an early feasibility study. So you're really trying to stay very close to the investigators, very close to the patients, understand everything that's going wrong in every case, with every patient after the case, because TADV, transcapillary arterialization of the deep veins, is a little bit different from almost any intervention we do in the vascular space. And that is that you do not see the real benefit of TADV until about 30 to 45 days later. Okay. So
you take a cold vascularization to happen.
It takes time. So you immediately take a cold foot and have a hot foot. Sometimes if a patient has a lot of pain, they can see pain relief, but we're after healing of the wound, right? That's the goal, healing the wound. And you won't see wound granulation for, to start, 6 weeks, right? 4 to 6 weeks. And so, you know, I mean, you do a coronary stent, patient feels better immediately, right? Almost everything we do, you know, you fix someone's aortic aneurysm, right? Patient's better immediately. TAVR, patient like tries to jailbreak the ICU because they feel so good, right? After years and years of having aortic stenosis. So one thing about LimFlow is that we not only had to perform a great procedure, and we ended up getting in both studies roughly 99% procedural success, but we also had to be very interested in what happened to the patient afterwards. And this added a whole new set of complexity. You have to figure out how to core lab adjudicate wounds, which isn't something that's been regularly been done, because most studies that have been run in peripheral are patency studies. You know, is the vessel open? In my mind, I mean, I want the vessel to be open, but I mean, the whole point of doing an intervention is to relieve symptoms, right? And that's where we were focused, is on symptom relief, which is healing in this situation and the avoidance of amputation and death. So so we had really had to figure it out from scratch, as it were. And that's incredibly difficult to do.
Woodley, I'm wondering if you guys can kind of dive a little bit deeper in terms of how do you assemble the group of researchers? It's so important because, again, as you mentioned before, that it's terrifying. And there's definitely an art to it because, you know, if it does not go well, you've wasted a lot of money. And for the researcher, I don't think any researcher wants to publish something to say like, yeah, this doesn't work, you know? And so how did you go about finding the right researchers and physicians who said, yeah, you know, we see the future here without having to see the clinical studies, right? That's the kind of the art part, which is you need to find somebody who can see the future with their eyes closed, right? How did you find these people?
Well, I took you're absolutely right. I mean, when you're doing a first in man, you need a doctor who is willing to put themselves out there and do a first in, right? That's a unique type of confidence, because if it goes wrong, right, you're in the wind, right, for doing something that's completely new. We had already gone past that. Dr. Stephen Kuhn in Singapore had already done this first in man, that had already done, 12 or so patients when I came on board. So he had had the courage, along with Tim Linehan, who incubated the company after Martin Rothman brought the idea. So they had done those patients together. And, you know, you need someone who has the courage to do that, because it is hard. You're taking a real person and exposing them to an intervention that you don't know if it works, and you may not know how to do it. And I've had the experience of working with first in men in structural heart and in other areas. And it's a really challenging moment to find someone who's willing to do that. Our early feasibility study, you're looking for people who, again, are definitely in the early adopter category. You want a lot of those folks, right? You want people who have a history of strong enrollment in the trial. We were very focused on the quality of data. So, you want really strong clinical teams, clinical data teams that are supporting the interventionalists, because you can have a great hands, but you have a terrible team that if they get audited, it's going to be a disaster because they're, you know, the files are all over the place, right? So you can't do one without the other. So you have to assess the team that's supporting the physician. You have to, not to get too, add too much, too many tough things, but you have to find somebody who's going to be there, right? If your trial takes 2 years and somebody goes to another hospital, it's almost impossible to continue really enrolling if that guy has left. The guy who picks it up doesn't have the same passion, doesn't carry it on for. So you're looking for stability. And one thing that I looked for, which is counterintuitive, but I believed it was critical, is I wanted people who were unconvinced. I wanted leaders. I wanted leaders in the, and particularly in the vascular surgery community, which is, again, surgeons are often a little bit more conservative in the adoption of new techniques and technology than interventionalists. I mean, interventionalists depend on technology from day one. You're an average cardiologist, right? You're using imaging to do everything you do. You're using catheters to do everything you do. You're always testing the limits in some way, or there's a cohort of interventional cardiologists that are doing that. Surgeons, and I started my career in cardiac surgery, surgeons are more conservative. You know, give them a knife, give them a suture, give them a needle, they can do amazing things. And I think that makes them a little bit more cautious to say, yes, we should change what we do. I did my apprenticeship and I learned how to do this one thing, but now I should throw that away and do something else. But I knew that vascular surgeons are often a critical part of the referral pathway. And at the end of the day, I figured if I can convince people who are skeptical and are highly respected in the field, right, then I'm going to win. We're going to win, right? And that's exactly what happened. At the end of the day, I won't name any names, but one of the real leaders in vascular surgery, came to us after the trial was over and said, I thought I would do one and that would be it, right? Because I wasn't a believer. Ended up being, you know, we had about four sites that were very close to being the highest enrollment, very similar, ended up being one of those. And he said, this works, this is fixed. And when that type of person gets on the podium, when that type of person is willing to publish and back you up with their more conservative colleagues, that's gold, right? That means that therapy is going to succeed. Because if it's just a bunch of people that, and we know there's always competition between disciplines in medicine, right? This is basic to our lives in med tech, right? That different groups compete for patients, right? They compete with each other naturally. And if you kind of have only one group doing it, it's very likely that the other group is going to say, ah, we don't trust that.
Right? Of course. Of course.
So I gambled and won on that one.
I love that you share that. These are the kind of lessons we want to hear. Keenam, I want to come back to you for a second, just because you sit in a very unique position, both as a physician and a clinician, and then also as an investor. I think every time you have a company like LimFlow, where you kind of were with them from very early on, it sort of starts to inform your future investments, right? Based on things you were wrong about, things you were right about. What were some lessons learned as an investor from the LimFlow story that you kind of take forward into future investments?
Well, there's always things that could go wrong, like Murphy's Law. Things always take longer, takes more money to fund the projects. Of course, these are nothing new, but I think it really sort of brought to the surface, I think, especially during COVID, right? COVID was an impact because the patients that are coming in are typically, let's say, 70 years old. So doing this in an outpatient setting, of course, when no hospitals were open, so really just keeping the trials open and getting patients recruited and keeping them, I think, in the study was a challenge. And of course, funding is always an issue with startups, whether it's early stage, late stage. And I remember Dan coming to me, and I believe it was our CEO day. Sophie Nova hosts a CEO of about 100 companies that are in her portfolio. And he mentioned that, hey, we're going to have more funding given where we are. And so the company was just about to take off. It had data. We were launching the phase 3. We had a really good momentum, but we need to really extend the company a bit more. So, of course, we were able to do that because we really believe in the company, the technology, and really the profound, the unmet need in the critical threatening limb ischemia. These patients basically have no options. And giving them to have another option where it's going to impact their lives as well, their longevity, I think it's well worth the process. And then we had other things that you can't control. We had some delays with the FDA, no fault of our own, and really a lot of sort of effort given by Dan and his team. And I think one of the things also that stand out when things are not going for you, whether it's delays, whether it's unforeseen events like COVID, it's so important as an investor that you have a CEO like Dan, and who also happened to recruit some of the best people in the peripheral artery disease business. Dan mentioned Thomas Engels. There's a few others that definitely deserve credit. When things go wrong, you need the right leadership. You need the right people that when the ship just goes off a little bit, to right the ship and to make sure the company executed, and we were able to do that. So what we talked about earlier, to me, the delays that we had, the COVID, a lot of things could have gone wrong, but really this is a testament to Dan and his team to right the ship, get the study done, get results that are really groundbreaking, get that published, and get an FDA approval. And of course, as an investor, we also like to see the companies that we invest in have an exit. And so, really, yeah, Dan did a phenomenal job during the difficult times. It's really easy to say, hey, they do a good job when times are good, but it's really when things aren't going good, how are they going to face that adversity, right? And so that to me, I think, was really something that I realized you got to have the right people driving that ship.
First financing and investment overall, not just in med device, but biotech, everything was down last year, anywhere from like 15 to 25%. The one thing that I'm kind of hoping to do personally, just as a mission, as part of this, as part of our show, is to raise awareness with LPs, with family offices, wealthy individuals, to say that, you know, they should consider their family legacies and fund more, you know, social good and impact investments like you see here. You know, granted, and you know, this is just a fact, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's a fact, but it's pretty true, which is you may not see the 10, 20, 30, 40, 50x return that you do get with like SaaS or tech, but I think you have the opportunity to make massive impact. So Dan, so something I want to ask you about, okay? And please, the more details, the better. How do you architect a deal, right, to an Inari, right after you get FDA clearance? Like, what was that period like? Because most of the time what people think is you have really good science, you know, you have some traction, big company comes along and says, hey guys, congratulations, today's your lucky day, here's a big check for an exit, shakes your hand, everybody's happy. But in reality, that's not the case. Like, these are really intense negotiations. There's a lot that goes into it. What are some things that you learned from that process you can sort of impart as wisdom to other founders and entrepreneurs?
I can start with, you know, how does it come about? It takes years, right? I think it's very rare for someone to wake up in med tech for, you know, whatever you can think, insert strategic name, you know, wake up and say like, oh, we want to get that. That was a great pitch. You know, that's not the way it works, right? In my experience, you spend years cultivating relationships with the strategics. I think I certainly can only speak for myself. I always overestimated how much resonance my communication with them was having. You'd go in and you'd say, oh, well, yeah, it was a great meeting with them. We were at whatever meeting it was, Viva or SES or, you know, ISED or whatever. We are there presenting. They really seem to like it. And what you don't realize is, you know, there are a lot of decision makers in these companies and the information is not disseminating to them you know, on a one-to-one basis as you imagine. So you really have to work hard to touch many points, right? I think you have to work over the years, just like with fundraising, to communicate what you're trying to do, communicate your milestones, hit your milestones, even if you're late, even if it costs more, because you are always late. Always costs more. right? And they know that. Keenum doesn't like that, right? But he knows it's almost always the case, right? Like, you know, it's a little bit different from public company where they're always like under-promising, over-deliver. In the startup, you're like waking up every morning like, we can really get there. And, you know, I mean, you probably can get there, but it's going to be harder than you think. And so raising money is the same thing, like constantly, you know, meeting, talking, cultivating, getting people, people's awareness of the company. You know, the relationship with Inari, you know, goes back to actually the raising of the Series D, which, you know, where we did have some early discussions with them. Some of the characters inside Inari, some of the folks, some of the leadership were known to us, and because it's a very small world, right? This this medtech world. So many of us have worked together at different companies before, or Sofinnova, for example, might be, they were not with Inari, but with other companies, they are an investor. So you have an introduction to the CEO, and, you know, and that, you know, maybe over 4 years, you get more and more airtime with those folks. So ultimately, we brought them in as part of the Series D, which, you know, I think was the right move. I was not 100% convinced at the time, because, you know, I do think having a strategic in, if they don't buy you, there is a downside to, you know, other strategics saying, why aren't they buying, right? Like, so, and if you have two or three in, then every board meeting can become a pitch meeting, which isn't the function of a board meeting, right? You don't want to go to your board being like, everything's great, you know, let's go, because the fact is everything isn't great. It's never all great. And you want to have very open, clear communication with your board about what's working and what's not, so they can help you. And if they can't help you, they are at least aware and not surprised. And so you don't want kind of two pathways of communication going on, right? That's very unhelpful over time. So we did bring them in. They were observers, wonderful observers. They have a tremendous amount of experience developing markets. They are a real market development company from a mindset point of view. I think when the more we talked to them, the more we got to know them, we felt like we had so much culture in common. And at the end of the day, they've taken a market that, you know, when they came in, there weren't a ton of believers that it was going to be what it is today. But they invested in market development for years, and that's our plan. That's the plan we had always communicated, whether it was to investors or to strategics. This is a market development opportunity. We're creating a market. It's not going in and, you know, throwing this into the bag of every rep you have, right? This is a tiger team developing accounts, developing, best in class outcomes. And then once you've nailed that in a commercial setting, expanding out from that. And I think they understood that very well. People think of it differently now because, again, in retrospect, you see how big they've gotten. But at the beginning, they understood we've got to get it right with the right accounts. And then once we know how to sell, once we know how to get great outcomes, then we can ramp it up, right? You can always pour gasoline onto the fire, but you can kind of only do it once. So I think they had that mindset. And when it came to raising a Series E, which, you know, at the beginning of, I guess it was last year, 2023, I knew I had to raise a Series E or I had to sell a company. And so from JP Morgan, I was raising around, you know, and I was trying to get someone to buy the company, and came back in, I guess it was late June. And I had a couple term sheets to fully fund the Series E from great partners. And we had, a potential deal with Inari. And so, you know, I did my job. The board came back and investors came back and said, we think we want to try and see if we can get a deal done. And then from midsummer, that really became the sole effort, right? And it is an all-encompassing, I think you know this, it is an all-encompassing, very lonely, very painful, very difficult binary process that you never feel like you're on solid ground until money hits the bank.
Yeah.
So
No, absolutely. And you know, it's something I want to point out again. As a founder, your fiduciary goal is to, you know, grow the company and have these acquisitions happen. As a guy who's sitting on, you know, sort of in the stands and watching this, personally, no offense to the strategics, I was more excited and happy to see a company like Inari acquire LimFlow because it just makes sense, right? It makes sense. It's, you know, Inari's got they have a market cap of like 3.4, 3.5 billion. They're not a huge, massive company, but they're growing their market. They're doing well. And it makes sense because the reps that they have, they're trying their best to own a clinical pathology, you know, around vascularization for the patient. And so this makes sense when it goes, quote unquote, into their bag versus, I'm not going to mention any names, you go to a larger company who's, let's say, got a market cap of, I don't know, 20, 50, 80, $100 billion. And now it's like one of many things in the rep's bag. And, you know, and incentives really do make a difference when it comes to how adoption happens. And what I've seen so many times over and over again, and again, I don't have a solution to this, is a huge strategic acquiring a company that's got amazing technology, and then it falls by the wayside, you know? And it's, and at the end of the day, people get hurt are, you know, patients. Patients are the ones who suffer as a result of that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a concern, right? And I mean, one thing you can notice, because we did, I mean, I can't even count the numbers of, like, you know, VC pitches and, you know, strategic pitches and then follow-up pitches. So it was a very dynamic process. At some point, we actually recorded the pitch with the entire executive team, which is about a 90-minute pitch. So we're just like, watch the pitch, right?
You record, sent it to VCs. I love that.
I mean, I never send anything that I haven't like had a one-to-one conversation and determined like it's going to be worth both our times. You know, I'm pretty upfront about like, how much money do you have in the fund? How old is the fund? What type of investments do you do? What's similar to what we are? You know, like you get a sense of like, you don't want to, I mean, you're not like just randomly shopping to have a meeting, right?
You pointed that out because I think too many founders do this, which is, I get it. Like when you're trying to raise money, you're trying to get it wherever you can, but you also have to, exercise some discipline and interview the person you're trying to get money from to make sure like, does this make sense? And also, again, you guys correct me if I'm wrong. The last thing you want to do is take money from the wrong person because then they become a huge pain, right? Especially in board meetings. And so I love that you're mentioning this where you scrutinize the person you're trying to get money from and then to accelerate the process, which, by the way, this is what my company's trying to teach salespeople to do. It's the same presentation. Why do you have to do it in person? Send them a video, have them watch, and then have a discussion. I love that. You're the first founder that I heard mention this.
Well, and it was great. I mean, it's great also because I have an amazing team. I mean, I just sit down and shut up and they pitch. But also, I mean, having folks like Keenom on board who know and can give you a lot of information about each fund, right? And what's happening and who the characters are and the history. And so you can have an investor who guides you, right? Not only makes introduction, but also gives you the backstory. So that can, you know, after you have the pitch, and it's very involved because we were really getting FDA approval. We were, you know, very involved in reimbursement, very deep clinical data sell, big market development story. It's not, you know, there's a lot to know about LimFlow if you want to invest in it. And so that worked for us. But it is a very heavy process. Eventually bankers get involved. Eventually lawyers get involved, you know, and then you're just kind of in a rabbit hole, to be honest, of trying to learn on the job. I haven't felt as out of my depth as since when I started at the beginning because, you know, these SPAs are complicated. You know, the legal agreements are complicated. There's a ton of nuance to it and there's a ton of like kabuki dance to it, right? About when are we actually going to, like, how many revs are we going to go through before we really get to like the real conversation, right? And I think the lawyers think it's about $1 million in revs before you get to that's my takeaway. It's a lot of revs.
Before you got to take
we could do it faster. That's what I think.
A quick question for you. And again, my role on this show is to, you know, have fun, but more important, like dig deep to unlock some insights. That being said, you know, I'm kind of acting on behalf of my audience. So like, I'll ask some questions that you don't have to answer. I would love for you to answer this one though. So if you look at the timelines, you know, you guys did a, you know, very robust and heavy R&D. You had that clinical data. You had the PROMISE study, which got published in New England Journal of Medicine in, I think, March of 2023, right? You had FDA clearance. So you're already in a position of leverage. You move forward to a Series E to raise more money. You get some term sheets, right? How important was it to go to that Series E and say, hey, like, I'm moving forward assuming that we're not getting acquired and I'm going to raise this money and get some term sheets? Like, because the reason why I mention is that I feel like a lot of times a med tech company, once they get something, especially in the New England Journal of Medicine, that are FDA clear, they're like, hey guys, let's just kind of coast right now, because any moment somebody's going to come in. But you kind of move forward as if that wasn't going to happen and did that Series E. Was, you know, am I reading too much into that? You know, tell me a little bit of, you know, about
I wouldn't be where I was if I ever raised my hands and said, I think they're going to come to us, right? Like, I think you make life happen, right? I think you have to be forward leaning. And for us, I mean, you're also looking at your cash position saying, no, we really have to raise money. I will say that I ran, and I think Keenan could comment on this. I was very transparent with, you know, because these are big, you know, big boys and big girls, right? So you're like, yes, we have interest from strategics. Yes, we do want to raise a Series E. Yes, we think IPO is a pathway that is really valid, and here are the reasons why. But at the end of the day, venture capitalists give you a lot of money, right, which you take, and they want a lot more money back, right? And so you have to figure out how to return capital. That's, you know, every time you raise a fund, it's about, you know, can I get this back to them at 3, 5, 10x, right? So if you can generate opportunities, then you have real comparisons, right? And so the board said, well, we don't know whether we want to sell the company. It depends on what the price is. We don't know whether we want to raise the money. It depends on what the price is. And we know it's a nuclear winner of fundraising, right? So, you know, but having two term sheets is infinitely better than having one, right? So, you know, we were in a good position, but I think there was a very robust conversation about which path to take place. But once it happened and we said, we want to go down this route of, you know, transacting, I went back to the folks, the VCs that had issued term sheets. And I said, this is what we're doing. And I mean, you remember Keenan at the board, we had this discussion. I said, I'm not going to jerk these people around asking them to do revs and, you know, change terms, you know, so we can get to better terms on a term sheet on a raise that we're not going to do. So I told them, we're going to pursue this route. You don't know who it is or, you know, how much it is, but we're going to do this route. And if it falls flat, I'm going to come back to you two first, no one else. And I understand you might not be interested. Your terms might have changed. I understand it'll be a different situation. We get that, but I don't want to waste your time. And I think that was very well received. It's a very small world, as you know, right? Everybody knows everybody. So, you know, I think it's a lot better to be transparent and deal with it with maturity, because than to try and create some kind of shadow game. Because if you really think you're going to sell the company, they also know it might not. Right. You don't know whether it's going to really happen until the very end. So it may be a case of like, yeah, it didn't happen because the acquirer changed their mind. It has nothing to do with what you're doing, right? So, and if that's true, you'll be able to explain it, and they will want to put money to work.
No, that makes sense. You know, I'm wondering, you know, you were there during all these board meetings, like when Dan came forward with this kind of proposal, like what was going through your head that day? Remember, everything's done now, so feel free to just. Air everything.
Well, I don't know if it was that day. I would say it was a series of days to weeks, maybe even months. I can start by saying Dan ran the process just as well as anyone I've seen. At the end of the day, Dan's responsibility is to build business, to build value, right? And of course, once you build value, how do you capture the value, right? And so Dan needs to still run the company. He needs to commercialize it. So he needs to secure the funding to make sure the business is run, right, for the long term.
Yeah, no, you are absolutely correct. And again, this is why it's LimFlow is such a great, I'll say this is that the industry we look for, just like anybody, like, you know, we talk about an industry, but this industry is made up of individuals and human beings who are influenced by emotion and stories. And so last year was a really, really rough year for our industry. Not a lot of exits. You mentioned, you know, a couple companies were essentially distressed assets. That's not fun. Money was not being deployed. And so to sort of, end the year with a story like LimFlow was really, really exciting and great. It kind of generated some new hope and energy for the space, right? And so I think it was fantastic to see that. At least for me, I remember when I saw the announcement, I kind of like pumped my fists up. And it was funny because I wish I had a camera in here at 24/7 because that day I was like, I was recording and I kind of like, you know, gave a shout and my wife's like, what happened? I'm like, company just got acquired. It was really exciting. But Dan, I do want to pivot real quick to ask you a little bit of a personal question. During these times, you are tested as an executive, as a leader, right? It is really, really rough, okay? During this time, whether it was a board member, a family member, friend, an employee, what was the most painful thing somebody told you that made you change for the better as an executive and as a leader?
Oh, my God. I don't know how to answer that. I'm not sure I have enough distance to it yet. I can't explain how overwhelming it was. I look back, you've probably seen this, the CEO of NVIDIA was asked, like, hey, you started this 17 years ago, would you do this again? And he's like, no, because the penalty is too high, right? And I could just say the penalty is very high, one of the challenges there is that, you know, it is a dynamic situation in the sense that you are in between a lot of different people, right? You're in between the acquirers, you're in between the investors who may have very different motivations amongst themselves, you know, founders, common shareholders may be different from, you know, Series D shareholders. You obviously have a preference stack, all that stuff to deal with. You have your employees to deal with who are concerned about what happens if you're acquired. So there are not a lot of friends and not a lot of places to go to. If it's lonely before as CEO, it's especially lonely now. I thank God every day for Paul Limmer, who was who's our head of finance, who was really, I leaned on him, and we were shoulder to shoulder throughout the whole thing. Am I a better CEO after this? Absolutely. I mean, I think you are making it up as you go along in some of these situations. And I've got a whole list of things that I don't think I did particularly well, whether I didn't communicate well, whether I allowed some things not to happen or to drag out that should have been dealt with before. It's almost infinite. And you really do want to take it seriously because you hope in a way that you're going to be able to be in the situation again, either as CEO, right, or working with another CEO and helping them achieve the same thing. And I love talking to other CEOs and sharing the experience, right? Because I think we are a little tribe together, and there are things that translate across deals. And I was just having a conversation with another CEO last night. Actually, I had two conversations yesterday with two different CEOs about, you know, the deal, how it happened, what were the learnings, et cetera. And, you do that because it lifts everybody up, right? Why should anybody else like go through the pain to learn something if I can, you know, give a little tip, right? It's all good at the end of the day. I'm not competing with them, right? And they're not competing with me. So let's help each other.
Oh, absolutely. And I can think of a better note to end on. I really appreciate you sharing that. I know both of you are on LinkedIn, so I'll encourage our audience to go and connect with you and follow you. Dan, just to, like, if I can put an idea in your head is, during this time, you know, it's still very fresh in your mind. And, I would encourage you, whether it's an article format or posts, but I think you should, do a few posts on LinkedIn, kind of sharing some lessons learned and stuff. And if you need any help doing that, reach out to me. Nothing makes me happier than helping CEOs kind of distill these lessons learned and share it with the broader MedTech community at large. I want to thank you guys for coming on the show. Big shout out to Bami of Sophie Nova, as always, putting together these amazing episodes. I really appreciate it. And lastly, any conferences real quick, Bami, I know we got to go, but quick question for Keenam and Dan. Any conferences are you guys going to be attending this year? You know, if anybody's attending, they can kind of, you know, make sure to look you up while you're there. Any conferences top of mind?
I'm going to be at, I think I'm going to be at LSX in London, and I'm going to be at Dublin MedTech. And there's another conference in Austria, the MedTech Europe conference. I'll be there. So all those are March, April, and then LSI in the fall. I'm not going all the way to Dana Point, you know, right now. Because
we're
going to
miss hanging out. Well, I guess
I know, but it's a...
Life. I'm like, hey, look, I got to go to Portugal this year. Okay, great.
Yeah. So definitely we'll be around as I think about what the next, what's the future holds.
Perfect. And Keenam, how about you? Any conferences this year that people can kind of keep an eye out for to see if they can run into you? Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, we'll be sure to keep an eye out for you guys and both those. I want to thank you guys for coming on the show. And for the people who are listening, if you're an LP or investor, you're new to MedTech, you're, you know, watching this show to learn more, I highly recommend go learn more about Sophie Nova. They have a fantastic portfolio of companies, wonderful, wonderful investors. You can learn more at sophienova.com. That's SOFINNOVA.com. I'm your host, Omar Khatib. If you haven't already, be sure to hit that subscribe button, give us 5 stars and write a review with the number one show in the MedTech. For these reasons. So with that, let me start that over. Okay, hold on. 105. Okay, let me put delete 105. Sign off. Okay, yeah. All right. Thank you for No, definitely. Okay. Perfect. All right, you ready? Okay, here we go. All right. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show. Big shout out to Bami Lee over at Sophie Nova, who does a fantastic job bringing these great guests on. If you're an LP or an investor, you're learning more about MedTech, you're looking to deploy some funds and invest in some great companies, I want to encourage you to go check out the folks over at Sophie Nova. You can check out their website at sophienovapartners.com. That's S-O-F-I-N-N-O-V-A partners.com. They have a fantastic portfolio and fund with a lot of great stories, so be sure to check it out. And lastly, don't forget, hit that subscribe button. Give us 5 stars and write a review. We're the number one show in MedTech, mainly because I always remind you guys to do this. So I'm your host, Omar Khatib, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you for enjoying another epic episode of The State of MedTech. If you're feeling inspired and love this episode, do us a favor, hit that subscribe button and turn notifications on so you never miss an episode. And be sure to give us 5 stars and write a short review because that helps more people discover this amazing community of ours. If you're a company who has a executive that you'd like to be on the show, or perhaps you want to sponsor one of the episodes, shoot us an email at hello@khatibandco.com. Take care. See you next time.